Hello, my name is Jen Makowski, and my favorite thing is S.E. Hinton.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things without using an algorithm. I am very excited tonight. Jen Makowski is back, and she is the reason I have authors on this podcast. She changed the whole trajectory of Finding Favorites, and I'm thrilled that you're back. Jen, how are you doing?
Great. I'm so thrilled to be back as well. I've been waiting for weeks to do this. I'm so excited.
And you're back because you have another book coming out.
I do.
The Company of Strangers.
It'll be out January 10th with Braddock Avenue Books, and it's a collection of short fiction.
So the short fiction, is it all COVID era writing, or is it like span your career?
It's a mix. I mean, I moved to Southern California 3 years ago, which spans the time I was last on your podcast, but a few of the short stories in this collection were written here. Most of them were written in Baltimore, though.
Still in Baltimore, yeah.
But the cover's really great. I have it's a cover of some surfers looking at standing in front of a California sunset. And it was so weird. Like, we live, I guess, about, it's like a 10-minute drive from the beach. And we were coming home from the grocery store, and we were at a traffic light. And I just looked over, and these surfers were sitting there kind of chatting. And there was this beautiful sunset behind them, and I just took the picture from the car, you know.
Wow.
And it turned out so good that I just wanted it to be the book cover, even though, not all the stories were set in this area. I just felt because they were all just kind of standing in their own, little thoughts, and they weren't exactly talking to each other, and they were all holding their boards, and it kind of reminded me of, a lot of the stories, how we just, people that we know are strangers, but then we also have these intimate connections with people we don't know, and it's, our whole life is just sort of not really quite knowing what another person is thinking.
Yeah.
So.
When did this book become a sparkle in your eye?
Well, short story collections, they take a long time to build because you just have to collect so many stories. And I think I started to play around with the collection even before I left Baltimore, and there were different titles, and it just never felt quite cohesive. So you just sort of put it aside. I actually wrote a novel while we were here in Carlsbad during COVID, and I'm still finalizing the draft of that to start sending out. But I did finally write the last story in this collection is a novella, and I wrote it here. And it just felt like the right piece for this collection. And then the title came from a title of one of the stories in the collection. And it just, I don't know, there's something you finally know when you have the right combination of stories. Mm-hmm. But it does take several years to come about. So a lot of this is pre-COVID. But I was, very active during COVID because we just didn't go anywhere for 2 years. And we had just moved here, so we had no... Even no bubble. We had no friend bubble either. So it was just sort of me and my partner and our dog, and the perfect time to have your own writing residency, I guess. But it's definitely changed, a lot of how marketing has been. Still, everything's kind of online, and I don't have as many. I have yet to build, it took 10 or 12 years to build the connections I had in the writing community in Baltimore, and it's coming about even slower here because things are still not quite back to normal. But, I think every industry has been changed by it. And it's just something you have to, go with the flow. And that's, that's life.
Yeah. I think we've seen it significantly from, my day job is marketing and financial services. Mm-hmm. And very few of our teams are back to in-person conferences. It's still a lot of webinars. A lot of the meetings that used to be required to be in person are all on Zoom. People aren't getting on planes anymore like they used to. So I see it in work. I see it at my synagogue. just where we've had people who have, who, and I understand, haven't felt comfortable to come back in person or liked the balance that attending online events brought to their life without the commute in the city. Because of Chicago, the effort to get somewhere in Chicago sometimes can be, you know, 30 to 60 minutes to get somewhere in the city. So it's been, yeah, I just have seen people clinging, and this, and now that it's cold and, you know, the sunset today at 4:19, people are, the people ran outside during the summer and now they're coming back to online events.
Yeah, it's a strange thing though. I joined a library book group here in Carlsbad when we moved here. And we've been online the whole time, and we actually met the other night, and I was like, is anyone interested in just not doing a meeting in person, but just meeting in person? Because I actually have never met any of you outside of these little squares, and you probably live like 10 minutes away. And everyone was sort of, some people were like, yeah, and some people were like, yeah. And it was like, you know, I know that attendance of the book club is like skyrocketed because people can just get on their computer and in their pajamas, and they don't have to. And it's, you know, it can be a pain in the butt after work. Make sure you're still dressed, or take a shower, or comb your hair, and go out to talk about a, you know, a book that you may have not have finished reading, even for an hour. So I get it, but it just felt so weird, you know. And I know, like, people younger than us, their whole lives have been brought up this way. It's really just us old, so we're just like, oh my god, now everything's. I mean, I know we've been sort of, you know, preparing for it with social media, but I just think about the old days, like when your bowling league was social media, right? You'd go out once a week, and that's how you'd get information and gossip and connection.
Yeah, I've talked to friends about a friend of mine who's in her parent, her dad has passed away, but when her dad was alive, he was the one that was, would take her mom, and like they would go to the bar in small town Wisconsin, because that is where they saw their people, they caught up with people, and how much her mom's social life has suffered because she was never the one who had to like take the initiative to go to the bar, because her husband would come home and say like, all right, now let's go, and let's go here, let's go there, and how hard that can be to maintain.
Yeah, I love that story though. That's great.
You really have to think about, is this activity outside my home worth the risk, worth the healthcare risk? Are the benefits I'm going to get for it, for the like social benefits, which I think are significant. I think the benefits of seeing people in person are significant. And are those, is that more important, or how do I balance that with the risk to my physical health? And it's, I, it's just, I wish I could time travel 50 years and see the research about what this time did for us. You know?
Yeah, I would. Well, hopefully we're still alive in 20 more and we'll have some inkling of how it's working out. But
For the launch of your, of this collection, are you going to, will you have an opportunity to go back to Baltimore and celebrate with your folks in Baltimore, or? Or is it going to be mostly online events? How are you thinking about rolling things out?
It's mostly online. Last year, I went back to Baltimore when You'll Be Fine came out. And I'm not doing it this year. But yeah, like I said, I've done a lot of just more interviews. And I've written essays and done podcasts and things like that. And I've, it's actually felt really comfortable to me. And this is someone, you know, I used to host a reading series in Baltimore for many years and co-hosted one for years before that. So I'm very accustomed to like being on stage and being with people. But I don't know, I just, as I've gotten older, like the energy has gotten less for me to be able to get out and and do that. And maybe that's why I identified with Essie Hinton's sort of history, because she's very reclusive and she never like goes out and does any sort of events now. And part of it was, she said, there was an article online about someone was sort of like her handler when she was like in Texas to do a book festival or something. She's just like, because basically I get asked the same like four questions every time. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine God, I love music. And I was listening to Isles and Miles, the Joni Mitchell live album, because I just started collecting vinyl a year ago. So I've just been on this like vinyl spree. And I got that and I was listening to it. And she's talking about how, you know, weird it is to like play your greatest hits at these concerts because, you know, no one ever, if you're an artist, no one ever says to, you know, Vincent Van Gogh, like, paint Starry Night again. I mean, sure, some people do, but, you know, it's weird that we're so, like, bound by, like, what we've already done. And even when you see bands, like, if I'm going to see a band in concert, like, I'm going to see, like, X this month at the Belly Up in Solana Beach, and I don't want to hear, like, I haven't even listened to their new album yet. But I definitely want to hear Los Angeles, and you know, so I get it as bands. It's, you know, it's wherever the fan, like whatever entry point the fan has to your body of work as an artist is what's important to them and not your whole career usually.
Yeah. There's some, one of the podcasts I listen to is the Jackie and Lori show. It's Jackie Cation and Lori Kilmartin. They're both women in their mid 50s who have been stand up road comics for 30 plus years. And Lori wrote, did monologue jokes for Conan O'Brien. But they have both been on the road for 30 years and they talk about the business of stand-up comedy, how the business of stand-up comedy has changed for women over the last 30 years. And they talk a lot about the churn of comedy albums, how like for a stand-up comic, it takes you like 8 to 10 years to have enough jokes for your first album. But then the culture in comedy is once you've recorded an album, that's all trash and you can't ever perform it live again.
Oh.
So by the time it goes on your album, it is the best. It's the best written. It's, you've got the timing down. It's the best it could be. But then because people can hear it whenever they want, comics believe like, well, then that's done. I can never perform it again. And it is the opposite of bands.
Right.
And then they talk about how sometimes people will try to request their favorite jokes. And they're like, well, maybe people do want to hear the jokes they know. And that debate about, like, do you want to always hear something new and unknown and surprising? Or sometimes do you want to hear the greatest hits? And I think it's interesting how it's different between media.
Although I would love to, hear a comedian do their old. I mean, I just, because there were certain comedy albums I listened to growing up, like Whoopi Goldberg's album. And I just remember the characters she did, like Fontaine. And I listened to, it's so much I could do the routine, you know, or like Joan Rivers. And I would just, yeah, I would actually be disappointed if I didn't get to hear like some of those jokes just because I grew up with them. But I totally get that. And I totally get, you know, I remember a period where I went to see a lot of Lloyd Cole concerts, and there was always a guy there who always requests, Mr. Wrong, Mr. Wrong. And I'm like, what, is he just following Lloyd Cole like I am? You know, and requesting this song that I don't even like. But yeah, I wonder how Lloyd felt about it, because he never actually played the song. But
So you brought her up, so let's get into it. This time, the favorite thing that you want to talk about, or one of your favorites, is the author Essie Henton.
Yeah, it's funny because it's like, you know, a no-no in writing books is like to make your author or your character an author. And I've already done that in one book, and now I'm going to talk about authors on the podcast. So, but
I didn't know it was a rule.
Well, there is sort of an unspoken, like, don't, you know, use writers in your writing because it's just, you know, it's kind of gauche or whatever. Or, but, you know, they also tell you to write about what you know. So,
right. You can't have both.
But yeah, like Essie Henton was sort of like my first, I wouldn't say literary author, but she was like my gateway to like writing novels or like feeling like an adultish novel could appeal to me. I just remember, I guess it was like 82 or 83, and going to the North Point Library every Saturday with my grandfather. And I would just go to the YA section. I would read everything that was there, like Lois Duncan and Lois Lowry. And, you know, I read the whole like row of Nancy Drew books one summer and have collected them over the years again. And I remember picking up this, and I'm pretty sure I read the book first before I saw it in 16 magazine, because I was a huge, you know, consumer of like teen magazines at that age as well.
16, Young and Modern.
Yeah. Tiger Beat. So Bop later. And I just, I read the book and I was thinking I hadn't, you know, I grew up in a working class neighborhood in Baltimore, and, you know, they weren't exactly greasers, but they were definitely a subset of kids that wore jean jackets and smoked after school and rode their BMX bikes, and they were all tough. And, you know, the
book is Outsiders.
Yeah.
Okay. Just checking.
And there was like, I don't know, there was just this picture of it. And I sent you the picture of the cover that I, that was in my library to link to the podcast. But it just, that cover and those boys looking so tough. And, you know, I guess I could just relate to Pony Boy. He was thoughtful and literate, but also sort of an outsider, you know. And it was we were definitely in a neighborhood that was, you know, blue collar, middle class. So I felt like there was something sort of, there was still like a glimmer of like a romantic hope that you could be this thoughtful character in an area that like was always just very coarse, you know, that for me, it was just getting called a lot of names, a lot of fat names or butch names or this and that. And for someone who was, you know, overweight and questioning their sexuality in the 80s, it wasn't like something I wanted to deal with. But I felt like I could like, you know, relate to these characters. And it's interesting because, well, apparently the book is based on a true story. Like Essie Hinton, when she went to high school, there were in Tulsa, there were greasers and socials, and a boy she was friends with who was a greaser like got beaten up while he was walking home from school, and she was upset about it, and she went home and just started writing, and that was her outlet, and that became like the first or second chapter of the book when. Or when, you know, they get jumped later in the book. But yeah, it was marketed as an adult novel. There wasn't like a young adult market like there is today. Like,
The market
is huge, middle grade and YA. I mean, you could just have your own Barnes & Noble, right? So it wasn't selling, but there was this like sub-market that it was selling in. It was like to kids, because teachers were teaching it in schools, and I wondered like what made teachers decide to teach it in schools, other than the fact maybe there weren't books that really spoke to other, you know, I don't know if they read Catcher in the Rye back then in the 60s, but I mean we did in high school, and To Kill a Mockingbird, but maybe they just weren't like hadn't become like what they were at that point in 1967 that they were in like the 80s and 90s when we read them. But so, and that's actually how the movie was made. Like in 1980, the movie version of The Outsiders, in 1980, there was a librarian at the Lone Star School in Fresno. And she wrote the director, Francis Ford Coppola, of all people, on behalf of her seventh and eighth grade students about adapting The Outsiders. It was like 100 kids who co-signed to this letter. And he was so like, you know, touched, and he's like, you know, yeah, I have to do this for them. And this is like, you know, Francis Ford Coppola, you know, this isn't like some starting out, you know, director, or this is a big deal. And I thought that was so cool that he just was like, yeah, we got to do this. And, you know, we got to find like, and a lot of the guys who were cast in The Outsiders, it was like one of their first films. It was their springboard for like greater fame. And you think about who was cast in the Outsiders movie. I mean, it's just like
really a who's who.
Yeah. Of like 80s, like male
future
like
heartthrobs.
Leads. Yeah, yeah. Like Matt Dillon and Patrick Swayze, Ralph Macchio, Rob Lowe. Oh my God. Even, Top Gun, Tom Cruise, Emilio Estevez.
Yeah.
It was just huge. All the guys that were in it. C. Thomas Howell that was his debut role, and it just I was reading, you know, back then they would all stay in the same hotel, but to get them in their roles, like Francis Ford Coppola would give the guys who were playing the socials or the more the upper
like
crust,
the better rooms, right?
Yeah, and they just to sort of try to create, I guess, a sense of resentment or. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, I'm glad that he sort of did that sort of method acting for them.
I'll look for the show notes. I think it was like Rob Lowe. It was either his interview on like Andy Richter's Three Questions or Armchair Expert, where he talked about, because they are like, they're high school students for the most part. Some of them kind of knew each other from the scene in LA, from the acting scene. And the stories from that set are phenomenal. Of the, right, sometimes some camaraderie, some competition, and then they just all go on to have these incredible careers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was just, I don't know, the staying power is amazing to me, because I got the idea because it was recently like on TCM, on HBO Max, is like, mm-hmm. you know, one of the movies to watch. And I was afraid to rewatch it, because I was like, not a lot has aged gracefully from our youth. But, you know, I was surprised that it still sort of stood up. And it, you know, it took itself seriously. It wasn't corny. And I could see, like, there was a lot of natural tension in the book. And S.C. Hinton knew how to, like, write a compelling scene that made you want to find out what happened to these boys and care about them, and then there's continued conflict. So it was really a good primer on how to write a novel. And I don't think she had much, like, it's not like she went to a writing program, or, you know, we're so
right
inundated with MFAs and this and that, but I mean, she really was able to find a natural, like, pacing and conflict, and it worked so well. I was impressed. And what I thought was funny is that it seemed like one of the most gut-wrenching or just difficult parts was like figuring out what to like title it. Like, I read an article in Slate, because I just thought she came up with The Outsiders, but she actually had called it A Different Sunset. That was the original title.
Oh.
And that, you know, I don't mind that, but it doesn't say, it just off on the shelf, reading the spines, it doesn't really jump out at you. But some of the titles that the editors had suggested to her during this process were, and they have some copies, if you go to the Slate article, they have some copies of the letters, correspondence between Hinton mm-hmm. and her editors. Some of the alternate titles were North of Division Street, which, you know, that sounds... It's very sort of West Side Story sounding to me. Mm-hmm. The Long-Haired Boys, very descriptive.
mm-hmm.
The Boys in Blue Jeans, and The Leather Jackets was another one. So at the last minute, you know, she came up with The Outsiders, and that worked.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine it under any of those names.
Yeah, I think it would just completely date itself and be irrelevant, mm-hmm. you know. So, but yeah, I just thought it was, you know, going back to the movie, watching that and the title, I just felt like, she was definitely influenced by products of her time too, like Rebel Without a Cause, you probably mm-hmm. were watching, and West Side Story. And I think about like, yeah, I think about that too in my own writings. I think about like the things that influenced me when I was, you know, 13 or 14 and writing. And when I was coming up in that age, you know, like 84, 85, just starting to read more mature works, but also reading Sweet Valley High still, because, you know, everyone likes Seth Sachrin in their life. But I just remember like the big authors then were like, you know, the literary Brat Packs. So it was like Bret Easton Ellis and Jay McKinney, so Less Than Zero and Bright Lights, Big City.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I didn't know much about like writing then. And I just sort of took this as gospel, and I spent too many years writing books in like first person and and second person, and just these very bare deadpan observations, thinking that was like
good writing. The way to write.
It wasn't until like getting to college later and like reading more widely that I was able to put that away. Although I actually just wrote an essay recently that will be out in the Cincinnati Review because it just stuck with me reading Bright Lights, Big City that young. And I was talking to someone about my collection and they made the observation that like five of the stories, like a good third of the book, had stories in second person, and how that's also sort of a no-no. Like when you're writing, people don't really gravitate to it much. But I apparently gravitated to it a lot.
First person is I. Like, it's like the voice is the point of view, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Third person, we know from Seinfeld, is like an omnipotent observer describing everything, right?
Yes.
Kind of. What is second? I don't remember what second person narration is.
Second person is like when you get up in the morning. You don't, or like the first line of Bright Lights, Big City. You're not the type of guy who would find yourself in a place like this.
Okay.
I had wrote like a bunch of stories like that, but I had to think on it for a while. Other than being influenced by this particular book, when I was growing up, is that I guess just being like a queer writer. It was an interesting time in history, and coming up, you know, in the like 2006 and 2007, there wasn't a lot of queer writing, and then it suddenly exploded, especially in YA and middle grade. And all of a sudden, I'm like 50 years old, and I never felt like there was any sort of wave to ride. Like somehow it passed me over, because by the time it became really like sought after, it was. Was a little older and out of the crucial market. I don't know, but I still felt like the need to write second person to like so people could see my side of the story. I guess I guess you're so used to reading third person and first person and perspectives that aren't your own. And for me, it was a way of sort of like easing people into a character that may be queer. All of a sudden you can't escape because you're sort of that, you are them, you know. But also maybe
second person can be so powerful. Somewhere behind me on my bookshelf is the book, it's a book about someone who survives round after round of layoffs at a marketing agency in the crash in 2002. Or 2001, 2002, the tech bubble crash in 99. Who knows which crash it was. And I read that book. And at the time, I was nearing the end of my career at my first marketing agency. And I was reading the book, and I was like, it made me really envious of everybody in the book. Like, this, the protagonist was surviving the layoffs. And I was feeling envy for the people in the book who were losing their jobs. And I was like, oh, that's a hint that my job is not good for me. If reading this book and being put into the space of somebody in a place where everybody's losing their jobs makes me want to quit, I then like took that advice forward. So I can see what you're saying, that by easing people in with second person and helping them like try on an identity and live in a story as someone who is not themselves. Because I had a reaction so visceral that I resigned and started my own company.
Wow.
From one novel.
Please put that novel title in the book notes as well. So I can,
I will, I know it it's like 5 feet behind me, but I don't want to, I'll it's put okay. it in, I, it'll be in the notes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. So is your essay coming out about writing in the second? Is it you reflecting on writing in the second person?
Yes. And yeah, it was just a lot of the issues we just discussed. And I guess, part of it was just, I guess our springboard was like, you know, sort of those influences, those inciting incidents you had as a impressionable young person. It really depends on what's around. And you know, for me, those particular books were like on the table at B. Dalton, and I remember the Less Than Zero hardback had a cover with like the Elvis Costello trust glasses, with the red and blue lenses, and I was just like taken by that, and I was part of the reason why I got the book. And yeah, so and with S.E. Hinton probably being a zeitgeist of her time and just what was going on around her. But you know, she didn't always write about greasers and socias, though, or socials. You know, when I was a child, I thought it meant that I was reading it in the book, and I thought it was socks, S-O-C-S, but it's socials.
Yeah.
So it's good to, it was good to see the movie and iron that out. So I was one of those kids that like had a big vocabulary, but had no idea how to pronounce the words because I'd only just read them. And it's still like to this day, sometimes I will, if I'm going to talk and I want to use a big word, I will go to Google and like Google and listen to how it's pronounced just to make sure, because I know I've like mangled so many words in my life just by seeing them on the page and learning them that way.
I feel like a lot of college was finding out what words I had been saying wrong in my head for my whole life at that point. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I had a roommate who pointed out every single one. I was like, thank you. Thanks.
That's exhausting.
Yeah. But she also wrote a book called Tex, which was about a boy in, and I think also in Tulsa, who lives with his brother. There's a real absence of parents in her books. I've discovered she wrote That Was Then, This Is Now, which I think it was the last of the four that she wrote for young people. And that was in maybe 71 or 72. But there was some drug use in that and psychedelics. And, you know, I was a little too young to understand or to like identify, or it actually scared me a little bit.
Yeah.
It was sort of like Go Ask Alice, which scared the crap out of me. And it did its job until I got to college and tried all those drugs. But, you know, for a while I was just like deathly afraid of like psychedelics and any sort of drug. She also wrote Rumblefish, which was sort of like The Outsiders, also a boy and his brother. She had this great thing with nicknames, because in Rumblefish, the main character is Ricky, and his brother was the motorcycle boy. And The Outsiders, you know, Pony Boy. Soda Pop, you know. So there were some great names that she had. Rumblefish was also directed by Francis Ford Coppola. It was a really art house sort of film. I remember seeing it in the 80s when it came out, and it was in black and white, except for the, there were some Siamese fighting fish, betta fish, in a pet store, like late in the movie. And the only thing in color in the whole movie are these fish, which is kind of wild. I think the brother is like colorblind. But
I know I saw Outsiders. I know I read it, but I don't think in Rumblefish I was aware of, but I don't think I ever saw it or read it.
Well, it's probably one of those that'll come out again in like TCM. Like I said, it's a Coppola film, and it was very artsy. It was probably a little more than it needed to be. You know, it was very high art. But it was, you know, also these, I think about all the things I was introduced to from other things. Like I know that Stan Ridgway of Wall of Voodoo did the soundtrack or the title song for Rumblefish. So I, you know, kind of got into him and his music. You know, through The Outsiders, I discovered who Robert Frost was and got to read his poems. And you know, I did buy a betta fish after Rumblefish. We had some in the household for many years. I remember discovering Oscar Wilde through Morrissey. So it's funny just how that sort of crossover, either like you'd read about bands and music and books, or you'd learn about authors through like song lyrics, you know.
Right. Yeah. Stuff.
So was there anything that like just like you were introduced to by like a band or a book when you were growing up that just like you just ran with it and it just became part of your identity? Or
so I was given for my high school graduation. I had one of my close friends in high school was the alternative, the Sunday night DJ on the college radio station. And he gave me a copy of The Stranger by Camus for graduation, of a particular translation. It was like a new modern translation of The Stranger. And I do have, I have gone on to collect translations of The Stranger, because it's a pretty, it's a globally published book. So I have a few different English translations. One that I bought in Paris, like at the Shakespeare Book Company in Paris. I bought a copy of The Stranger, but then I also bought a copy of it in French from a random, from like a guy selling books on the banks of the Seine River in Paris. And I bought it a copy in Argentina. A friend who went home to China bought me a copy of it. So that's kind of a book that I have a long relationship with.
So how many copies do you have now?
Like 7 or 8.
Wow. Well, if I see any in my travels, you know I'm going to send you.
Yes, send you one, please. So what I still need, for all the times I've been to Israel, I haven't bought a copy of it yet in Hebrew. So that is high on my list. But I'm sure there are... I was very confused when my period started because pads in the 80s didn't have like a belt. And are you there, God? Oh, it's me, Margaret.
Yeah.
Right? She had the pads with a belt. And so I was very confused where the, like, I was very mentally prepared for the belt. And then there wasn't one. So I remember like, just like not being prepared because of what I had read in the book so many times. Mm-hmm. But Judy Blume actually went back and she has continuously revised the technology in Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, to be like what was actually available.
Hmm. I'm going to have to do some research on that.
Yeah.
I just remember that terrifying me, like reading about, like, I was like, what is this happening? And then I think I, you know, got this, the like 911 at like school from like a guy, my brother's friend, Paul, because my mother took me aside one Saturday morning. She's like, I want to talk about something. And I was like, okay, you know, and she's like, mm-hmm. I heard you talking to your brother while, this is so dated. I heard you talking to your brother while you're playing Atari this morning. And you told him that when you got your period, it's when you peed red blood, as if there's any other color, right?
Right.
You peed red blood and had a baby. And I was like, first I was like, I didn't say that. And I still have no recollection of saying that. And then I know she didn't make it up because I just did, it wasn't in my mom's, like, you know, she just, I couldn't see her making up something like that.
Right.
But I had, you know, when you're a kid, you just like have these like blackouts, right? Mm-hmm. Or something, because you just do not remember things you said. And I was like, I didn't say that. But I probably said all kinds of shit when we were playing Atari.
Right.
But I do not remember because... but yeah, and then she sat me down and told me how it really worked. And then a week later, I got it. And I was like, God, she cursed me.
She jinxed you.
Didn't she? Like, it just...
Yeah.
Yeah, but that book scared... I know, like, you know... But for some... God, I can't imagine growing up in a family where you didn't talk about it at all. And it just...
Right.
And I've heard so many stories of, like, girls who are just like, I started bleeding one day and I thought I was dying.
Right.
I mean, can you imagine? I just... But so I'm glad for this public service that Judy Blume has done, but it just scared me. So it scared the crap out of me when I read it.
Yeah.
But I think it's because we were probably both precocious and we were reading above our grade level and we were probably reading things that we should have still been, like, reading fifth grade, whatever, you know.
Yeah. No, books, once I started reading... like my sister was a stronger reader earlier than I was. And then I might have told you this story on our last interview. I won a copy of Stuart Little as a prize for something at school. And my twin sister read it first. She read it before me. And I was like, that is the last time you're reading one of my books before me. And then from then on, then really until like the start of COVID, I was like a reader. And then COVID broke my brain. So yeah.
Now, does your sister collect any books? Like,
She reads a ton still. She reads a lot on the Libby app now.
Mm-hmm. Great. I love that.
I did get her a copy of They did like a 50th anniversary release of Banicula.
Yeah, I love that book too.
And it's like a red velvet cover. So I got her a copy of that. I don't know if she has other books she collects, but she'll text me when she hears this.
Yeah, because I want to know. I'm going to put that in your notes too. The book that your sister may be collecting.
Yeah. And then we came to the end. That is the book about losing your job. And then we came.
Then we came to the end.
By Joshua Ferris.
Okay, I'm going to look that up. I'm going to look it up on Libby. That's the first place I'm going to look. Yeah. Great. It's a great app. Yeah, I'm just so like amazed that like going back to the outsiders that it just has so much cultural staying power because like I'm sure kids reading it now have no idea what greasers and socials are. And I think I had some awareness just because in the 70s when I was a child, like the 50s, we're seeing such a huge resurgence. So I was like exposed to like American Graffiti and Sha-na-na and Happy Days, whereas kids now are just like, what's Happy Days? What's a greaser?
You're like, well, in episode 2 of WandaVision.
Oh, yeah. I guess they do kind of sneak it in there, right?
They sneak it in there a little bit, yeah.
I don't know if they're still reading it now, but I do know that like you can, there's merch that's still on the internet that you can get like Stay Gold, Pony Boy. But then there were some people that really like were introduced to it late and it was surprising. I was reading, there's an article, I think in the New York Times or New Yorker from Lena Durham, who was like, I didn't learn about this book until I was in college. And you know, it's because someone in one of my classes that I had a crush on told me to stay gold. But you can, you know, you can buy like sweatshirts and t-shirts that have Stay Gold on them.
Yeah.
And all these online cafe press like stores. And yeah. I think that the coolest thing that I discovered about The Outsiders is that the house that they filmed in the movie that the Curtis brothers lived in, it's now a museum. It's the Outsiders' house in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So I know we were talking about bucket lists earlier, and this is actually would be something on my bucket list because I've never been. I think I've driven through Oklahoma. It was unremarkable on the way here to the West Coast, but I would like to stop. If I ever get back, I'd like to stop and see the Outsiders' house. You know, and there's just a lot of like not seen pictures. Photos from the movie from behind the scenes and things like that. What happened was I think it was scheduled for demolition and there was a hip-hop artist named Danny Boy O'Connor and he was a big fan or he is a big fan of the movie and the novel and he bought the house in 2016 so actually quite recently.
And
he was able to save it and now you can I think for $10, go and get a little tour and see all the rooms and see all the photos and stuff like that. And I'm sure there's a gift shop there too, and I'm excited about that.
Yeah, and I've got some friends who have moved to Tulsa in the last couple of years, and I think for like a weekend, I think there's lots to do there. It seems like there's a good food scene. It seems like, they're having according to their Instagram, like really enjoying. They moved from Chicago to Tulsa and they're really enjoying it. And there's really kind of I think because it's so affordable, there's kind of some either like they're recruiting people. They're openly recruiting people to move to Oklahoma and move to Tulsa to change the environment. It's not quite the word I want. Get more people there. Get more things happening.
Yeah, I see that a lot on some of the like the more of the politics forums. There's always a bunch of people are just like, we need to get a bunch of progressive minded people to move to some of these states and try and make a dent. And I think it's slowly happening just because living in California, it's like just so expensive. And
So expensive.
even anywhere in the Pacific Northwest, it's become, or the West Coast has become completely unaffordable. And a lot of people move to Texas, but then they have property taxes and laws that are not very, good for people like
Yeah,
women and queer people and people of color. So
I think people, well, businesses moved to Texas because they were drawn in by like the no, either it's no sales tax or no income tax. So like they recruited all these huge companies to move, and Plano just became like nothing but corporate campuses. There was an era in my life when I went to Plano all the time for different companies. And then I think all those people have finally realized that the politics of Texas is not South by Southwest, right? That they just couldn't imagine what it was really like there. And at their state, I interviewed James Tallarico for Answering the Call, which is volunteering I do with military vets who want to run for office. People who have done public service who are trying to decide if running for office is their next way to serve the country. And James Tallarico is a state representative, so he's at the state level outside of Austin, and their state legislature meets once every 2 years
Wow.
for 6 weeks. Because their constitution was written before airplanes. So it was like you
Oh.
think about how long it would have taken to travel from like the panhandle to Austin to the capital and back. And how are you going to ask a farmer or a rancher to do that more than once every 2 years? And the whole state is governed with these convening laws developed before airplanes. And that to me, that boggles my mind. And it partially explains how they're so capable of gerrymandering and strangling the people of Texas, because their legislature never meets.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I do think going to Tulsa to see the Outsider Museum,
Oh
House
yeah,
Museum, would be really nice.
I'm totally, I think you can do that, like you said, in a long weekend. So, and when it maybe gets a little warmer too. But yeah, I was trying to think, like, were there any other like literary places or things that I'd want to see like turned into a museum? And it's kind of hard. Like, I know that the house in James Joyce's The Dead is the street. It's still, it's, there is a house in Dublin that his aunts owned, and it was the inspiration. You can go see that. I don't know if they give tours or whether it's a private home,
Yeah.
but so I would definitely do that. I wish there was like a House of Leaves house, but how would that work? I don't know. But and I would definitely go to like Milwaukee to see like anything Laverne and Shirley related. But that's, I know that's not a book, but that, yeah, that's as far as I got. So I'd love to,
Yeah.
if anyone else has any like suggestions from books of gift shops, I would love to
Yeah,
hear
I'm
them,
trying.
because this is my favorite right now.
So I just picked up a graphic novel biography of Eugene V. Debs. So Eugene V. Debs was a socialist presidential candidate from my hometown in Terre Haute, Indiana. So his house across the street from my elementary school had murals in the attic depicting his life. But the house he like, I don't know if it was the house he was born in or the house that he like ran his presidential campaigns from, is still in Terre Haute, Indiana. And he wrote, speech upon speech and pamphlet upon pamphlet. So I think that's a good museum, house museum to visit.
Oh, and of course, duh. I'm from Baltimore, so the Edgar Allan Poe House in Baltimore is one as well. And
There's also an Edgar Allan House in Richmond, in Virginia.
Oh, is there? Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. I do remember that. And there's probably something in Philly, too. Yeah. There's sort of this rivalry, like, who gets to claim him?
Mm-hmm. And I do, I mean, I feel like it's cliche, but I wouldn't mind going to Key West to see the polydactyl cats of...
Oh, yeah. You should go. I did, it was a long time ago in college, yeah. But I did go to the Ernest Hemingway house.
Yeah.
Back then.
Yeah. So, but I don't know, like, there's not a little house on the prairie house, I don't think.
No.
Every wardrobe... is the possibility of being the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, right? Any freestanding wardrobe?
Right.
You have to check them all.
No, I guess there's not a huge Harry Potter fan as some people, so I don't know if there's a place in London where he lived, like the suburb that he lived in, or there's not anything like that, right?
You can go to the platform 9 3/4. In London. So they have it, they've got a photo op set up, and then on September 1st at 12 o'clock noon every year they do they put it on the board and they do a train call for the Hogwarts Express on the day when they would have gone to school.
Okay.
I don't know why I know that, but I do.
Well, I'm glad that you do.
Yeah.
Because now I know. And there's too.
The Christmas Story House in Cleveland.
Oh, I didn't know that existed too.
Yeah. Hmm. And it's essentially, it's a house in a residential neighborhood, and they've bought a few of the houses nearby. So you can walk through the house where they filmed it. And then I think other houses have the gift shops available. And then there's just a ton of signs not to park on the street because it is a residential neighborhood and the people do want to have their life.
Right.
And that house, I think, is for sale. It's on the market.
Oh, okay.
That museum.
Yeah, I had a really great book a long time ago that was basically just like all the different locations in San Francisco and the Bay Area were like different scenes from Alfred Hitchcock movies were had taken place.
Yeah.
And I did remember going up to Bodega Bay for the day. We were out there last and just looking around and seeing where the birds was filmed. And... But yeah, so S.E. Hinton, she wrote those four novels. She wrote one more for YA. It was called Taming the Star Runner in 1988. I'd moved on by then, so... never read it. It's not on Libby, so I couldn't read it for this podcast, but I'm going to definitely try and look it up over spring break and see if I can just find a physical copy somewhere and see how it compares to the S.E. Hinton canon, as it were.
Yeah.
The Outsiders, That Was Then, This Is Now, Rumblefish, and Tex.
Yeah.
So.
I need to ask my sister. That Was Then, This Is Now, I'm pretty sure we had. I think we had The Outsiders, Rumblefish, and That Was Then, This Is Now. But I don't think Tex and Taming the Star Runner, I don't think we had those.
Yeah, Tex was the last of the four big ones, and that one was published in 79, and then there was like a 9-year interval between Tex and Taming the Star Runner.
Yeah.
So, but Tex, actually all of these... those four books, The Outsiders, That Was Then, This Is Now, Rumblefish, and Tex, were all made into films. I know we talked about The Outsiders and Rumblefish, but Tex was also a film with Matt Dillon, who played Dally in The Outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
And then That Was Then, This Is Now, I don't think I saw it, and I don't think that it was any of the sort of Brat Pack guys, as it were. But yeah, I don't think I saw the movie of that. But yeah, if I was, I mean, she's had a great career. It would be lovely to have four of her novels adapted into movies, and you know, one of them still being like read so taught, widely, yeah. you know, and taught in schools. And yeah, so, but yeah, she was just a big part of my life as a reader and as a writer growing up. And, you know, I owe a lot to her books and her perspective and her just writing a story that she wanted to write that she didn't mm-hmm. see. You know, I'm sure she was growing up reading things like Gone with the Wind or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so there wasn't really a lot of, and, you know, I think she even, her name is Susie Hinton, and the editors obviously wanted her to publish as S.E. Hinton because I think that they were worried that people wouldn't believe a woman could write a man's perspective.
Right. You know? How could she write about teenage boys?
Right. Even though yeah. she as a lived teenager. Her whole life with them. Right. You know? So, mm-hmm. But that helped me too, to also write in both sexes and genders. Yeah. And I mean, there's just a lot that I owe to her. She was sort of my gateway drug to writing in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Louise Fitzhugh's Harriet the Spy. Like, I could spend another podcast talking about that book. It's one of my favorites. Now, that's a real character who is also very complicated and complex mm-hmm. and human and terribly unlikable at times and frustrating. But mm-hmm. and you never saw that sort of character in children's literature before, you know, before then. And she also did all those lovely illustrations in the book herself. And, you know, she wrote, and like S.E. Hinton, she wrote a few other books, but they weren't quite as popular. There was one, I think it was The Long Secret that came out a few years later that was told from Beth Ellen's kind of point of view. Mm-hmm. It was still omniscient, but it was more about Beth Ellen than it was about Harry. It was more of a minor character.
Yeah.
In this book. But yeah, so sort of similarities. And I remember getting, last thing I'll say, I remember just getting that from my aunt. My aunt went on vacation to like a beach town or something. It was Virginia Beach. And she went into a bookstore because she knew that I liked to read. It was like, you know, 10 or 11. And mm-hmm. she was asking the clerk, like, what were some good books for a young girl to read? And my aunt was like, I don't know, 22 at the time. Mm-hmm. And this clerk, my aunt was explaining to me, thought that she was asking for books for herself.
Oh. You
know? And I'm like, that she thought my aunt was like, I don't know, 17, 15. I don't know. Oh, it's just kind of
how strange.
My aunt always looked young. She had that sort of Ralph Macchio sort of mm-hmm. young glow about her. But so the clerk at the store recommended, and this is what my brother and I got, but really me, because my brother didn't really care about reading. Mm-hmm. Even though he was an English major in college, my aunt brought home the aforementioned Bunnicula, The Secret Garden, and Harriet the Spy, and that. So I have her to thank for my introduction to Harriet the Spy and Bunnicula.
It's a good trio.
The Secret Garden, And also those bookstore clerks know what they're talking about. You know, if we ask them for suggestions.
Yeah. So if you had the opportunity to do a fireside chat with S.E. Hinton, and you know she's tired of answering the same old questions. Do you have some questions that you kind of teed up should you ever run into her in an airport or on a stage?
You know, I haven't, because I would be a little embarrassed. Like, what do you ask?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you ask that perfect question?
Yeah,
you know, I'm sure I guess I would just ask her if she still writes on the side things that she doesn't want people to see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think as a writer, you just never stop writing. So I can't imagine she's stopped, even if she's been reclusive. I think she has she likes horses and has a horse farm or something. Mm-hmm. She still lives in Tulsa. She likes not being a celebrity. She likes being, she said, a resident.
Yeah.
So, and I get that happens. I mean, it just happens to a lot of authors are like that. I mean, in Baltimore, we have Ann Tyler, also very reclusive, but also mm-hmm. just, you know, has written like what, 10 novels or something about Baltimore.
Right.
So, it's just how, I think it's how, Hinton and Tyler sort of, and lots of writers, including myself, just sort of connect with people. 'Cause it's hard to like, and I'll do it because I have no shame mm-hmm. to strike up a conversation with someone in public in line, you know, it just, we're not good at that sort of like soft skill of like, or like promotion or putting ourselves out there. So it's just, it's always ironic to me that authors are sort of responsible for so much of their promotion when they're just so bad at it, because we just don't like to even talk about it, you know.
It's so the opposite of writing. I have benefited from the need of authors to go and do their own promotion, because I truly, after you came on, your publicist reached out and was like, that was amazing. Can I introduce you to some other authors? And she introduced me to a whole bunch of them. And so I still have authors coming on to this day because you came on with your last book. So it's been really fun. I've met so many people, and I have been able to start reading again. And because really, the COVID just wiped it out for me.
Oh, I understand. Me too. Yeah. Like, there were a few years when I wasn't reading at all, like less than a book a month. And I think joining a book club helped, because then you felt like you had a deadline and
and some social pressure.
You read that extra chapter every night, even if you didn't want to. But it felt like just like using a muscle I hadn't used in a long time. Mm-hmm. Once I started reading and finding books I really enjoyed, I became hungry again for more, and having that experience and emotional connection. Mm-hmm. So, I'm glad that you found your way back to it.
Yeah, I've been working on, I just finished listening to a Mike Nichols biography. Mike Nichols was in Nichols and May with Elaine May, comedy duo of the 1950s. He was the director of The Graduate. He won like 7 Tonys for Best Director. And it's just, I think within any cultural scene, there's the person who crosses a few boundaries and just seems like they know everyone. And Mike Nichols was active in what he was like active in or touching or responsible for so much pop theater and movie culture that was created from like 1950 until his death in 2014. And he's almost like Forrest Gump, because he's, after JFK is assassinated, he's one of the people that Jackie O will be seen on the town with, because he's trustworthy and won't make a move and can talk to anyone and will get her, like, he's just everywhere. And it was fascinating to me because, and also just shows how wealth and network and proximity is responsible for what makes it on the big screen. You know, like, oh, well, we rented this house in the Hamptons next to Leonard Bernstein, and I got to know him swimming with our kids. Like, it's just all this stuff that was, it was wild, but engrossing to listen to. So that's like the big story that I just finished listening to. And then I'm reading a book of poetry called Our Cancers by Dan O'Brien. His wife had breast cancer, and then almost as soon as she was in remission, he was diagnosed with, I think, colon cancer. And their daughter was a toddler. And so I'm sort of, I'm testing the waters with I might still be too close to my own experience to be reading cancer stuff right now, but it's really beautiful poetry. So,
yeah, please link that one too, or both of those. Actually, I'd love to take a look.
The Company of Strangers is coming out, you said, January 10th.
Yes.
But people can pre-order now, which is very important. The pre-order that you can. People could pre-order it now and print it out and give it to somebody for Hanukkah or Christmas, and then tell them their book is on the way in January.
They could. And I'm actually, I bought like a big pile of vintage postcards, some, you know, just off like eBay or something, because I've always just loved old postcards and collecting them. And for every person that pre-orders a book, I'm sending them a hand-chosen postcard with a personal message of thanks. So I just get to share my collection of postcards.
I love that. Where? How should people tell you they pre-ordered a copy? Or is your...
Well, if they pre-order from Braddock Avenue Books, you know, I have the list of the pre-orders and the addresses, and then as soon as pre-orders close, I'm going to sit down and look at the list and start working on picking out postcards and writing them out to people who have ordered. So
awesome. And where can people keep up with you online?
I'm on Twitter still. You know, I joined Hive recently. I'm not sure if I'm going to stay there. I think we're all still looking for like the backup plan for Twitter, but it seems to be a little stable, more stable now. So we'll see. And it's strange to have been on Twitter for so long and built up so many friends and relationships and then have to start over somewhere else. But I mean, I guess we all might have to do it. And but at the same time, part of me is like, well, you know, if I don't catch on somewhere else, maybe that's okay. Maybe that's okay too. That'll be a few more hours of each day that I'll have to do something else, you know, but yeah, thanks Seth for asking. I am on Twitter at Mikowski Jen, one word.
Great.
Your
literary journal as well, right?
Yes, JMWW. And you can just do a search on that, JMWW. And we publish, still we're publishing fiction, nonfiction, flash fiction, poetry, interviews. We have a couple of columns that run each month, and we're basically a weekly journal now. We actually are, we used to do print anthologies for a while, and then I stopped. And we've recently teamed up with another publisher, Modern Times Publishing, and they're publishing a bunch of anthologies of different literary journals that have been around. And earlier this year, they approached us and said, do you want to be the first anthology that we publish? And I said, sure. Yeah, so in 2023, we'll be back with a new anthology, and it's going to cover like the best of maybe the last 10 years. It's going to be a pretty chunky book, but you know, all our editors voted on the last 10 years of submissions, and we got all those together, and it's in the proof stages now, so we'll have that come out in 2023. Sort of a big thank you to all of our contributors over the years.
Nice. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for coming back to talk about S.E. Henton.
Thank you for having me. I always love talking to you.
It's so
I always learn so much more from you than you probably learn from me, but I just I'm glad for the opportunity. You're so well-rounded and versed in so many things.
Or I appreciate it. I will take that framing. I am like a sieve or a flypaper for trivia. I'm really good on trivia teams.
Good. I'm going to remember that when I pull out my Trivial Pursuit and
yes,
going to have to zoom you in as my partner.
Oh, I used to keep a backup copy of Trivial Pursuit in my car.
Wow.
When I lived in Colorado, in case I went to a party and it wasn't fun enough, I'd be like, hey guys, I have a solution.
Oh, that's pretty intense.
This was in like 1999 to 2001. I would go to my car and get my copy of Trivial Pursuit just, you know, in case we weren't having much fun.
Now, did it liven it up? Because I have to say, I had a similar like impulse in college, but it was usually I was really drunk and I was like, let's play Pink Floyd. And that was like a party killer, always. Yeah. But did this have the opposite effect? Everyone's like, all right, 3 hours of intense trivia.
Sometimes they would let me. Sometimes we would play.
Most careful
and
wording
sometimes
there.
It was just a bit, but I literally kept a copy of one of my copies of Trivial Pursuit in my car.
That's ballsy and awesome. I love it. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.